Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Black Sabbath, Magic, Myth and Mayhem is the subject of a new book out by Greg Healy. Adored by their fans, of which I am one, and loathed by critics. Across a career that's spanned nearly 50 years, Black Sabbath have divided opinions more than any other band. From heavy psychedelia to heavy metal, this band of Brummies ploughed their own unique furrow, that's saying something, releasing a trove of albums along the way and cementing themselves as one of the hardest working and most influential live acts in the world. It is the subject of a new book by Black Sabbath by Greg Healy. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, I think from the People's Republic of Cornwall. Greg himself.
That's correct.
Good morning.
Yes, although I'm not a native son of Cornwall, as you'll probably tell when you hear my voice.
I was just thinking that. I keep saying good morning. I think it's because it's been one of those days. But good afternoon to you in Cornwall.
Good afternoon to you too.
Sabbath, a band, a name, a brand almost. They have gone their own way. There is nothing like the Sabbath, and there is nothing like Black Sabbath fans.
No. Well, they defied all expectations, and I think that really sits at the core of the book, really. Four working class lads from your neck of the woods in the West Midlands.
Indeed.
They weren't really taken in by the music critics at all, and they had quite a tough time sort of getting acceptance. And I think one of the things I explore in the book is how they dealt with that.
I mean, Black Sabbath, the first album comes out, is it 1970, isn't it, Black Sabbath, the original album?
Yeah, that's right. 13th of February next year is the 50th anniversary of their debut album.
And blimey. And, I mean, the album cover, the tolling of... I told you I was a fan. The tolling of the bell at the beginning. Whilst Led Zeppelin were doing their bit and everybody else was, like, reinventing the blues for a white audience, this was something completely different.
It was. I mean, they took some of the elements of progressive rock that were around and some of the elements of heavy psychedelia. But I think it was that Devil's Interval, that riff that Iommi came up with that really defined their sound and gave them something very unique and very different. And I think their music was criticised as being sort of leaden and simple, but it's anything but, really. It's complex and it's intricate and it's interesting.
And you can
at least it is to... Sorry, go
on. You can argue that it really it is a concept album, that first album, and also it reflects where they come from, the heavy metal, the heavy industry of the West Midlands.
Well, it does. There's a lot of interest in at the time. It was very popular to be into horror films and things, and they used to practice across the road from a cinema, and I think that was the thing that gave them they kind of noticed this, and it kind of gave them the idea that they should maybe try and capture that kind of interest in music. The bells that you mentioned, I mean, there were things, they were lucky because Roger Bain, who was their sort of first producer, he kind of, he understood their music, he knew just how to pitch it, and he was the man that came up with the bells and the rain at the very beginning of that first sort of track, Black Sabbath. Yeah.
And how did they originally meet? Did they spring fully formed, or was it, because you've got Ozzy, you've got, Tony Iommi, Geezer and Bill Ward. I mean, did they know each other before? I mean, because I know that there's the famous thing about Tony working in was it a steel?
He was a metal machinist.
That's it.
He left school at 17. He was the son of they were Italian shopkeepers, and they ran a business. And he left school at 17 in 1965. Now he was at the same school as Ozzy, and they all grew up in the same area. But Tony used to bully Ozzy.
Right.
so there was as their story unfolds, those kinds of, this is something again that I explore in the book, it's the tensions in their relationship and things like that. But they all came from different directions. They were sort of Tony had was in a band called the Rocking Chevrolets originally, and then yeah, it's a great name. And then he got this what I think was at the time he probably thought was his big break with a band called the Birds and the Bees, and then he lopped the ends of his fingers off.
Well, isn't the story that he was going to leave before lunch, and his father said, "You've got to go back and do that one shift."
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the other thing. Apparently, well, some stories have it that his dad said he had to go back. Other stories have it that his mum said he had to go back to work. So all the way through their story, there are contradictions. It depends who tells the story, really. But yeah, I mean, they, you know, and the thing is, Ozzy himself was kind of a bit of a scoundrel at the time, and he was nicking and burglaring and things like that. And somehow he came across a PA, and that's how he got involved with Tony Iommi and Bill Ward and Geezer Butler, yeah.
And how did they make it from being, obviously, I mean, Tony had to reinvent his sound at that point. Obviously, they had to get a gig quick before Ozzy got nicked for having a nicked PA. But how did they get out? Yeah. Because there were a lot of sort of white guys doing rhythm and blues and that sort of thing around that area. How did they get their big break and stand out from the crowd, as it were?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because they were... Once they'd got together and they were playing as Earth, they weren't really going anywhere. And I think what actually happened was that Iommi left the band and because he was invited to go and play for Jethro Tull down in London.
Right.
So the story could have been over before it began. And he went down to London and he was kind of... But he missed his mates, you know. He was homesick. And so he didn't really hang around with Jethro Tull. He kind of took part in one or two things. And then he kind of came back. But he came back with a kind of a new focus and, you know, a newly realised professional attitude. Because he saw how Jethro Tull did things. And he brought that to the band. And obviously then they practised, more diligently. And they had more focus.
Because when you think this is the thing. When you think about Sabbath, everybody thinks about the excesses, the mid 70s, Sabotage, etc. But you have to get to that place, and they toured and they played and they practiced, and Ozzy came out as a frontman like no other.
Yeah, well, it's strange actually. I mean, they played all over Europe. They toured non-stop. They played at the Star Club in Hamburg. They were the famous venue where the Beatles played. And there's a story that just before the venue closed for good, Sabbath played one last sort of rotation there, and they packed the place out. You know, more fans were there than were there for the biggest Beatles night. And, the thing is, they weren't afraid of hard work. They really did put the miles in. But a lot of these bands did. You know, a lot of these bands on their way up, that's how they did it. You know, we didn't have the internet back then.
And also, of course, a lot came because of the powerhouse rhythm section, which is Geezer Butler and Bill Ward. You know, this is the original incarnation of Sabbath. And, you know, if you look at great bands and great foursomes, you can say that between 1970 to Sabotage, which is 74, 75, there was, it tails off a bit at the end there, but there's nothing to match them as accomplished musicians. Nobody's sort of being dragged behind them.
No, well, this is it. I mean, it's fact. I mean, the whole dynamic of the band actually changed because, I mean, they used to all stand in a line, and Ozzy wasn't in the centre as a frontman. He would stand to the side. And that sort of changed over the course of, over the course of, like, the years as they progressed over the first couple of years. And then you had, like you say, you had Ward and Geezer Butler, and they were this solid rhythm section that drove the sound along because, obviously, Iommi's guitar playing, he played chords, obviously, but he also played these kind of lead riffs as well, this very distinctive sound. And he used to tune down his guitar so he got that heavier sound, which you could hear on the track that you played, you know, just before I came on air.
Yeah, and was it a very, very quickly they got a reputation and a following? Because, again, I mean, rock fans are fans like no other, I think it was Tommy Vance famously said at Donington when he was being pelted with all sorts of bottles. I mean, Sabbath fans, it's a religion, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, well, they did. They built up a solid following from way before they got the record deal. And when they were sort of picked up by Jim Simpson, who was their first manager, and Tony Hall Enterprises bankrolled their first album. They were signed to Vertigo. When their first album came out, Black Sabbath, it did extremely well and surprised a lot of people, and it was built on that fan base that they'd built up through touring. So yeah, they put the hard yards in.
And then they just start bringing out album after album. We've got Master of Insanity, and then of course Paranoid, which is a huge hit.
Yeah, well, they did. It was Black Sabbath in 1970 in the February, and then in the September there was Paranoid, which was 1970. So that's in the space of 1 year. Then in the July there was Masters of Reality, which again was a pretty quick turnaround. And then obviously in I think sort of 72 they had a bit of a break because they were touring really intensively and doing a lot of USA tours as well. So that Volume 4 came out. Now this Volume 4 is the kind of change where Roger Bain had fallen away and Tony Iommi started to take control of the production a little bit more. He wanted to he believed he could shape the sound better. And then it was basically then after that sort of intensive period, it was an album a year after that. But obviously, by the time Sabotage came around, all the legal problems started to unfold. You know, they were in disputes with Simpson about money and things like that. And then they discovered that Meehan, now I need to be careful, but they had disputes with Meehan as well. And then Don Arden took over as their manager, and that sort of opened up the whole story that would then eventually become Sharon and Ozzy. many years later, she managed them for a while. I mean, she was heavily involved. She had a huge reputation in the music industry, you know, by sort of 1975, 76 anyway.
I've interviewed Carmen Appice, who was drumming for Ozzy in with his band, and he speaks about Sharon managing Ozzy literally sort of second by second.
Definitely.
What was it?
Well, Carmen is the older brother of Vinny, who drummed on Heaven and Hell, so there's the family connection there as well.
Exactly. Now, talk me through the US tour, because, you know, Led Zeppelin had gone over and gone massive in the States. Nobody broke the States like Sabbath, you could say.
No, and it's a thing that was kind of overlooked by certain sections of the music press. They were as Grand Funk Railroad were a huge band at the time in the States. They were playing this kind of heavy metal type music that I think it was Lester Bangs who coined the phrase heavy metal. And Sabbath were on a par with Grand Funk Railroad, playing these huge arenas. I mean, vast arenas, you know, with hundreds of thousands of people. It's kind of difficult to imagine, really, on a much bigger scale than the festivals that we have today.
And how was how does the travelling affect them? Because obviously, this is when the sort of the folklore begins to build up. The excesses come in, and like you said, because they've got their eye on touring and trying to keep their own stuff together, perhaps they're not keeping their eye on where the cash is actually going. Because they're basically making this up as they go along.
Well, they are. I mean, they were like so many. I mean, it's a story you'll have heard a million times. You know, artists, they just want to make music and they don't really think about the business side, and they sign bits of paper and they trust what's going on. But they were also taking huge amounts of drugs as well, which I think kind of affected their judgment. And you know, I'm guessing at that one. They were touring, they were living that rock and roll lifestyle, they were more and more detached from, you know, their kind of core cells, if you like. And that actually then began to take a toll on the creativity of the band. So, you know, this is when, you know, sort of towards Sabotage and then Technical Ecstasy particularly, they lost their way a little bit, really.
And of course, we then have sort of certain members losing the plot, leaving the band. You've got Ozzy going off and being replaced, by Dio. But if you're going to bring a replacement, Dio, hugely underrated singer.
Yeah, well, the one of the core things of Sabbath was that they had this kind of practical joke, kind of hijinks thing going on, and it was very much rooted actually in the traditional factory kind of atmosphere of where they came from. You know, they had lots of practical jokes and silliness, and that was turbocharged by the drugs they were taking, I think. Ozzy fell to pieces because he was basically an alcoholic, I think, by the end. And Ronnie James Dio came in. Now, he was an excellent musician in his own right. He could play sort of various instruments. And he actually helped them because, I mean, they really were. They were broke. They'd lost their direction. And when he came in, he helped refocus the sound and refocus the band. I mean, that's when my kind of connection with the band, I say connection as a fan, started. I mean, I was very young, but I was taken by my brother to see the Mob Rules tour and the Heaven and Hell tour. I think it was about 12 at the time. My ears.
I was going to say.
Yeah. He actually, it's funny, he took cotton, my mum made him take cotton wool with him, and I had to have cotton wool in my ears.
So the 80s, I mean, an interesting period for Sabbath, and then it goes quiet. Ozzy's done his own thing with Blizzard of Oz and the albums and that sort of thing. And in the past, say, 10 to 15 years, aided by a reality TV series and the fact that the band got together, I mean, they've had a huge renaissance. I know that Bill Ward hasn't come back, but, you know, like Prodigal Son's returning, we had Ozzy come back and we had Geezer come back and we had the album that was 13.
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, 13 is. I mean, the book tends to focus more in more detail on the early years, right up to Ronnie and sort of Vinnie joining and that character thing. And then I do deal with that strange period when you have Ian Gillan joins, and there's a kind of a bit of an all-star Sabbath thing going on. You know, various members coming through. But yes, 13. That was around the time that Iommi was diagnosed with lymphoma, and I think it was seen at the time as a bit of a last shot, and they all got back together, and apart from Ward, who didn't want to come back in. And you know, then there were various attempts to tour and record again, but Ozzy was so busy. I mean, he's been hugely successful, more successful than any other member of the band. Mostly because of how Sharon had managed him, I think, and also because of his appeal as a personality. But, I mean, his music's amazing as well. And then, obviously, that brings us up to a couple of years ago when they did The End, which was the final, you know, bow and, you know, saying goodbye, you know.
So why did you decide the time was ripe? Is it the 50th anniversary that you thought, you know, we should have something to mark this occasion and to look back at what made these albums and what made this band particular? Because if you mention Black Sabbath, everybody knows Paranoid, everybody knows Iron Man, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the anniversary. Last year was the kind of anniversary of them becoming Black Sabbath when they chose the name Black Sabbath and decided, apparently, on a ferry on their way to play gigs in Europe. And obviously next year you have the anniversary of this wonderful debut album. But I've long been interested in, you know, how the band came about and all the various different forces at work, you know, all the different characters and, you know, it's just a really interesting story about, you know, about how a band of working class lads try to struggle their way to the top of the music business, and in a way their desire for acceptance shaped their sound and kind of made them lose their way a bit, I think.
So how do you go about, because we're talking about sort of the myths and legends and we've got the dark bits and pieces and all the sort of backstage excess and et cetera, et cetera. And that story about losing his fingers, you know, how do you work out, you know, what is fact, what is fiction, what is faction, what is Black Sabbath, hashtag fake news?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's even in the interviews, so I went right back to the music press of the 1970s, you know, Record, Mirror and New Musical Express and things. And even from interview to interview, they contradict themselves, which, as you can imagine, leaves you scratching your head when you're kind of researching. But what I've done is, rather than trying to settle on a definitive narrative, I've drawn parallels between the different approaches that they had. The Black Magic thing was quite interesting because they used that as a way of gaining notoriety. And then almost as soon as they'd done it, they started to back away from it because of the adverse press reaction.
I suppose if you're touring in the States, then, you know, that's not going to go down too well either, let's face it.
No, well, this is it. You see, this was one of the problems. And, you know, they were attracting all sorts of undesirable elements to their gigs. But at the same time as well, they would bring it up at every press interview or press conference or any interview they did, they would mention, oh, I suppose you're going to want to talk about the Black Magic thing, are you? So even in the process of denying it, they were reinforcing it. So it's quite interesting. It was a very clever game, actually, that they were playing.
And when you go back through the music press at the time, because there's no online reviews, etc., and you know people would get Melody Maker, Sounds, etc., you know, Musical Express. Although Musical Express obviously hated Sabbath. I mean, how? What's it like reading? There must be a certain almost innocence to the reporting.
It's very good. I mean, this is the heyday of music journalism. These journalists were paid decent salaries, and they followed the bands around. The thing that seems to come across is there's some of them are just grinding axes, and they've decided before they've even heard the album or been to the show or interviewed the band that they're not going to like them. And I think this lies at the heart of a lot of the kind of the bad face that Sabbath felt was given towards them. But I wouldn't say it was naive, really. No, I mean, by then there was an awareness after the 60s. There was a lot of journalists lamented the kind of optimism of the 60s going and dying, and they were looking for a new sound. They were looking for something to carry music forwards, you know.
I'm just thinking, because I interviewed, is it Alan James or Alan Jones, who famously got beaten to a pulp by Tony because of...
Well, that's right, yeah. Yeah, punched on the nose for saying something horrible about them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I think it happened at Blue Ball Services or something. He happened to see him, and then that was it. Yeah, I think he made a bit of a mess of his nose, actually, but... Yeah,
you can't really imagine that happening in the social media, sort of Facebook type, you know, everybody's got a camera in their phone, social media of today, can you?
No. Although, given some of the kind of argy-bargy, some of the difficulty between Taylor Swift and her management, who knows? I mean, it's there are still crazy characters.
Yeah, but with gracious respect, Greg, if you got a death threat from a Taylor Swift fan, you wouldn't be worried, really, would you? But if you got a death threat from a Sabbath fan, I mean, you wouldn't sleep at night without a crucifix, would you?
Well, no. Well, the thing is, as well, you think about it, Sabbath received threats from the chief witch of the UK, you know, because of their involvement with black magic, and they were cursed, which is another thing that goes through the story of Black Sabbath. So things were more vivid, I think, back then, in a way.
So, what do you hope that people will take from the book Magic, Myth, and Mayhem?
I think. Well, what I took from the process of writing and researching it is how courageous they were and how hard they worked, you know, really, how hard they worked and kind of what a lot of bad luck they had along the way. And, you know, it's a real story of kind of hope and loss, and you know, it really is. It's and then in the end they do succeed again, and it's friendship. That's what lies at the core of it, really. It's friendship. It's the friendship of the four original members of the band.
You see, I never thought that when we spoke about Black Sabbath, Magic, Myth and Mayhem, it would be a simple tale of a heartwarming tale of four guys. It's like a Brummy Stand By Me.
You know, it's funny, as I was saying that, I was thinking, what on earth am I saying?
If you have to pick out one high watermark, though, of Sabbath in their pomp, what would you say it was?
You know, it's funny, I loved the early days. I really loved, I loved the story of them when they first played the Devil's Interval riff. A pub, I think it was Leamington or somewhere like that. They played a pub, I can't remember the name off the top of my head now. And the story is that everybody stopped talking and stood open-mouthed and listened. And I think that kind of really encapsulates the power of their music.
The book is called Black Sabbath, Magic, Myth and Mayhem. It's out on the 9th of December by New Haven Publishing. It's by Greg Healy. Greg, if people want to find out more about the book or about yourself, where do they go to?
Well, they can find me on Twitter if they go to Healy Island, which is HEALEYISLAND, so that's all one word. And if they go onto Facebook, they can look for Greg Healy Writer, on Facebook, and they'll find me on there, and it's got some of the other books I've written there as well.
Look forward to that then. It's been a pleasure to speak to you, Greg. The book is also going to be available as a download on the TRE website when it comes out on the 9th of December. Having gone through the Black Sabbath catalogue, does anybody else cross your sort of sights that you wouldn't mind having a crack at?
Well, I think next up I'm writing something about Motown. I think I've got a book lined up about Motown, which is a very different thing altogether. But, I'm really interested, because I started to read about Grand Funk Railroad, and they sound fascinating, so I'd like to have a look at them in more detail, I think. I'm sure it would be another heartwarming story of several friends running off into the sunset.
Several friends running off into the sunset. The book's called Black Sabbath, Magic, Myth and Mayhem. It's by Greg Healy. Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Yes, and you too. Thank you. And thank you for having me on your show.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money.